External Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Belkin, and this is my co-host and brother, Mitch Belkin.
We're resident physicians interested in medical innovation. This podcast is our attempt to explore new ideas currently on the outskirts of medicine. This is not professional medical advice.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. We do not endorse any healthcare providers or treatments. Our views do not represent the views of any official organization or institution.
If you'd like to support us, subscribe to our podcast or leave us a review.
Or you can follow us on Twitter at @exmedpod and tell your friends.
We're here with Professor John Cochran, who is an economist and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. John, welcome to the External Medicine Podcast.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get started, do you have any financial disclosures?
None that I want to share with you guys. None that is relevant to anything I will say on the show today. Thank you.
So you have a very interesting background. You got a bachelor's degree in physics from MIT, and then you got a PhD in economics from UC Berkeley, and you've published extensively on a whole lot of economics topics, including monetary policy and exchange rate volatility, but you've also written about healthcare and health insurance. So I guess my question is, how do you describe what it is you do for someone who is not familiar with your work?
I'm an economist. And a lovely thing about being an economist, it's like, maybe being a doctor in the 1800s, we're at that level. Being in a less well-established field means that you don't have to totally specialize and you can range around. We have a few simple tools which are very powerful, thinking about incentives and thinking about budget constraints. There's money doesn't grow on trees. There's only, if you do more of one thing, you have to do less of another. Take those two little insights and you can romp around the world and understand all sorts of puzzling things. So it's a great life being an economist.
How did you get interested in healthcare specifically?
So this started, I've always been, I've always read the newspaper. I was walking into school one morning to work. This was around the time of Hillary Care. It looks like before you guys were born. So long ago in a galaxy far, far away, there was Bill Clinton had a healthcare reform project that looked something like the ACA. But a big problem the big social problem was that of pre-existing conditions. So as I was walking into school one day, I realized, I have a solution to the problem of pre-existing conditions, which became a paper that I got published in the JPE and then more popular version. And so that started me thinking about it kept thinking about it, wrote a second essay after the ACA, much, much later, putting together more thoughts about it. That got me going. And as an economist who thinks and cares about public policy issues, you got to have at least some superficial ideas about some things. And we do a lot of putting things together too. So I follow a lot of health economics work to try to get as a concerned citizen, try to get a consistent view of what one should do here.
We want to talk about that 2009 piece you wrote about health status insurance. But before we get there, I want to ask you about why we should consider healthcare just like any other economic good. There are a lot of people out there who say healthcare is a human right in order to justify strong regulatory oversight within U.S. healthcare. By contrast, you argue it's an economic good like any other.
Thanks. I think it's important to start with these basics. Healthcare is an economic good like any other. That's just a fact. It can be provided by the government like other goods, or it can be provided privately. Healthcare is a complex personal service. It is in its essence no different than, or your contractor who provides a complex personal service, your car mechanic who fixes your car, your vet who fixes your dog, your tax accountant. There's some interesting economics there. It takes, as you guys are busy discovering, it takes a lot of training to become a doctor. Doctors tend to know a little more than their patients about what's actually going on. But there's nothing fundamentally different about medicine than everything else, and there always was. Now, the question of rights, boy, immediately political and moral language gets thrown around things. What I love being an economist is to try to understand cause and effect in human affairs without getting distracted by politics and getting all hot under the collar. I might say, healthcare is a human right. Absolutely. You have the right to take your money and pay any doctor who's willing to serve you to serve you. That's a way of thinking about human rights that is unusual. Now, usually when people say it's a right, what they mean is it is a right that that your fellow citizens through taxes have to pay for your healthcare. And then we'll talk about how much healthcare via the government. That's not exactly a right. A right, I have a right to free speech. That means, the government can't stop me from talking. A right that is, you guys have to pay for my foot surgery. That's a very different kind of right. And that's a political language that I don't think is very helpful. So we have a good, it's an economic good. You guys are doctors. I presume you're hoping to get paid someday for being doctors. So the question is, does the patient pay you or does the government use taxes to pay you? That's what we're talking about.
One of the rationales that people use for claiming that healthcare is not an economic good or ought not to be considered one has to do with inelasticity. The classic example is if you're in a motor vehicle collision, there's no sense of shopping around for a particular hospital where you're going to get particular treatment. Alternatively, if you need a new heart, there aren't too many alternative substitutes on the free market, though hopefully xenotransplantation and pig hearts will at some point be more widely available. But how do you think about healthcare as being an elastic versus inelastic good and how that would relate to what sort of regulatory environment we ought to or ought not to have for healthcare?
Which is, healthcare is an economic good. There's just no getting around it. It is. When you say it ought not to be one, you're saying it's an economic good that perhaps the government pays you to deliver for me and I don't have to pay for it, but that doesn't make it a non-economic good. Public schools are an economic good. The government raises taxes and gives it to you for free, but it is an economic good. Ask the teachers how much they want to teach without being paid for it. So the only question is, how are we going to pay for and ration this scarce resource? It is an economic good. I'll just keep repeating that. I understand people use this rhetoric. They say it's not an economic good, meaning it is an economic good that we want the government to provide. Since all money eventually comes from taxpayers, it's an economic good. Now, the inelasticity question, perhaps the right way to put it is that is something anybody who's taken economics 101, you meet the free market and its wonders, and then you meet a litany of things that might go wrong with free markets and that at least in theory justify government intervention. You tend not to meet, here's how the government interventions also always go wrong. You meet, here's a theoretical reason why a omniscient, perfect, technocratically competent government might be able to do better than a free market. Now, I don't remember inelasticity being one of those. So let's parse down this argument. Some of what you say is exactly right. If you are having a heart attack, you're not in a good position to negotiate a good price with the ambulance. So that's a fact. Now, does that justify American healthcare, by the way, is completely screwed up and just about as screwed up as public run healthcare systems. I'm not going to defend the current American healthcare system. But you've had a heart attack. You're in a poor position to negotiate with the ambulance driver. That's right. When your tire blows out, you're also in a poor position to negotiate with the tow truck driver. Does that mean that tow trucks are not economic goods that the government has to provide? No, we seem to do okay with that. One thing is, you're a human being. You understand that tires occasionally go flat. You join AAA. You also tow truck companies know that it's important for them to have a reasonable reputation. and they are actually quite anxious to provide a decent service and not to gouge. It's quite remarkable, actually, in the free market, how seldom it is that you get gouged, completely gouged, if your car breaks down in the interstate in the middle of Arizona somewhere. So I would say the same thing of the mythical heart attack where you're in your poor position to negotiate. You are in a poor position to negotiate. So, buddy, think about it ahead of time. Why don't you buy yourself some health insurance? Negotiate hard on your completely free market provided health insurance and make sure you've got health insurance that is going to help to cover, like your AAA, that's going to cover you in the event you have a heart attack. Second, we need abundant competition on the supply of people who are going to help you with your heart attacks, who are very anxious to keep their reputations for not screwing patients alive. I mean, imagine hospital, picks up patient with heart attack, charges $1 million. Well, actually that happens all the time in our current system with a little more competition and a lot more Yelp ratings and a lot more disclosed prices. It would happen a lot less. So I don't see that as a, inelastic good, especially one that's fairly predictable that you're going to need at some point in your life. Just does not seem like a reason that this is, market complete failure. And I might add, now here, I'm going to ask you some doctor questions. What fraction of health spending is a unexpected, life-threatening crisis that needs to be dealt with right now? And what fraction of it is going in to see your doctor for the update on how my diabetes is doing? Or going, regular preventive care. What fraction of appointments can be scheduled within 6 weeks? And I'm talking to you, Stanford Healthcare System. Or what fraction can wait 6 weeks, apparently, in our current horrendous system, that free competition would get you a lot quicker service. Where this is a reductio ad absurdum. There's, one case of somebody who forgot to get health insurance who's in a little bit of trouble, but that's not 99% of healthcare spending and the issue, and one that we can, I think, deal with. So sorry for the long answer, but I've heard that question before.
So we want to talk about your piece entitled After the ACA, Freeing the Market for Healthcare. So one of the interesting things you say in that piece is that when most people talk about healthcare, they're actually talking about health insurance. So I just want to have you delineate what those two things are and how they're different from an economics perspective.
Thank you. And I'm really, you guys are doing a great job of clarifying specific issues before we, run into a bar fight, which I appreciate. Health insurance is there to protect your pocketbook. Healthcare is there to protect your life and your health. Health insurance helps you to buy healthcare, but these are completely separate quantities. Now they sometimes are rolled in together. There are companies like Kaiser where you pay a fee, and that is both insurance and care all into one, but they're economically separate quantities. And, most hospitals are organized as hospitals that then bill insurance companies who do the paying for it. But I think that would be useful for us in thinking about policy to distinguish those things. How do you protect people from the financial consequences of an unexpected health problem? And what's the best way to get people care when they need it? And somebody's going to end up paying for it.
It was great to hear you or to read you in the piece talk about, we don't go to our insurance companies when we need an oil change. And yet to have your annual checkup or whatever small healthcare related transaction, it requires an escalation to a big healthcare a big health insurance company.
Yes. Why is it that your home insurance doesn't, quote, pay for light bulbs, your car insurance doesn't pay for oil changes, and yet health insurance, people can keep confusing having health insurance as access to healthcare. No, access to healthcare is they have enough money to pay for it. But why do we, and you don't, I think the joke was you don't go into the to Jiffy Lube and then fax 6 pages to your primary oil change specialist, who then recommends what kind of oil change comes back, faxes 6 more copies. There's a bill for $10,000 with insurance discount to $800 with copay of $20. And then you got to spend 3 weeks on the phone with the claims adjuster over the $29.95 to change your oil. Why is health run that ridiculous way? Well, there's two original sins that we'll get to, but the first original sin that I want to talk about is the tax deduction for employer-provided group health insurance, which came in. It was a good time to talk about that. It was one of the chaotic things our government did in the late 1940s in response to inflation. They put in price controls and wage controls, but workers didn't want to work without being provided more wages. So they said, well, we got to make it look like we're holding down wages. So what we'll let you do is you can have health insurance payments can be slipped in and you don't pay taxes on them. Now, many things in the U.S. are workarounds for high tax rates. And if you're in any reasonably high tax bracket, anything that you can do as a pre-tax money, you save 30, 40, 50, in California, 65% of the money you save by not having to pay taxes on it. So, health insurance started reasonably. There's a, $2,000-$3,000 deductible, as there is for any other kind of sensible insurance. And it doesn't pay for Band-Aids. But if we can make it pay for the Band-Aids, then we get to do it out of pre-tax dollars and we save that money. So that's why health insurance expands to be a payment plan for just about everything. Now, the second reason health insurance expands to be a horribly inefficient payment plan for just about everything, which is the second original sin. The second original sin is the massive cross-subsidy we have. Rather than taxing and spending to provide health care for poor people, what we do is we force us to overpay, and then the hospitals, we force them to provide charity care and other uncompensated care and underpay for Medicare and Medicaid. Once you have a cross-subsidy going on, you don't have competition going on, and the whole thing becomes a big mess. So that's in part why things are much more expensive they ought to be, and why you can't just go out and why there isn't a competitive supplier to undercut the expensive version and give you the $29.95 Jiffy Lube.
So in 2009, you wrote a piece for Cato in which you discuss health status insurance. What is health status insurance, and why do you think this will lead to portable lifetime health insurance?
So there is there's two problems with health insurance. One, how do we provide insurance for health care for people who don't have enough money or who would choose not to spend what money they have on health care? And that's the issue we talked about. There's a genuine problem. There was a genuine problem among people who pay for health insurance of the pre-existing conditions issue. So where we got to was the problem that in health insurance lasts a year. And then if you get cancer within that year, they will pay for your cancer treatment for that year. But at the end of the year, they say, you're out of here. you don't get insurance anymore. And especially when insurance is tied to your job, if you get cancer and then lose your job, now you're out there and you call up an insurance company and you say, I've got cancer. How about health insurance? Their answer to you is like somebody who calls up, say, my front porch is burning. How about some fire insurance in my house? It's going to cost a lot of money. So now that this is it's a pocketbook risk. I mean, they would insure you, except at extraordinarily high rates. So you have this, again, it's not necessarily a health problem. It's a pocketbook problem. You were not in that system. You're not insured against the financial consequences of getting some disease that doesn't just require treatment this year, but that is going to raise your expected health for your whole life. And that was a problem with health insurance. Sorry, meet me the dog. I hope you could edit that out, or we'll all say hi to Bia the dog.
Hi, Bia.
It was a good moment to take a breath. Now, this is the thought I had as I was walking into work that morning in, I think, 1992 or so. We can solve this as an economic problem. Being diagnosed with an expensive disease is a insurable event, just as is, having your house burned down or the treatments you need for the cancer. If the insurance company, you get cancer, the insurance company pays for this year's cancer treatment and then gives you enough money in a big check so that you can afford higher health insurance premiums for the rest of your life, then you can have a completely competitive deregulated health insurance market, but you are insured against these long run lifetime problems. And so the paper goes in, there's lots of implementation. How do we work it and other ways of doing it, which I won't bore you with unless you force me to. But that's the basic idea, that you can get insurance against the need to pay higher health insurance premiums. It's going to cost you something. And then even if you get cancer, and then you can have that kind of insurance is individual. There's no reason health insurance shouldn't be part of your job. Your home insurance isn't part of your job. Your car insurance isn't part of your job. Why is health insurance go with your job? Why do you lose it if you get sick and lose your job? Answer, the government only gives a tax deduction for employer-provided group plans. The employer gives you money that you send to a health insurer or to a health status insurer, that doesn't get the tax deduction. So that's why don't we see it? Bing, right there. We started seeing health status insurance, private markets. You see, in the history of medicine, back in the 1940s or 50s, there wasn't much you could get that would raise your health costs for a long time. You could break a leg, they fix the leg. Done. No reason to raise your health insurance premiums. You could get cancer. 1945, getting cancer, see you later. We might put in a free casket for you, but it's not going to raise your health insurance premiums. There's nothing we do about it. Now, the idea of lifelong expensive things is a new one. And health insurance companies were adapting. So the first thing they did is they put out guaranteed renewable plans, which is almost as good. It's and we have that with your life insurance. So the supply and demand, people needed this, companies were providing it. They were saying, pay us a little more and you'll get health insurance and we will guarantee that your premiums never go up if you get sick. It's not perfect because as long as you stick with us, health status insurance lets you move from one to another. So there's an advantage, but that was there. And in fact, United Health was offering a wonderful idea. It was offering to young people the right to buy health insurance. So you're young, you think you're an invincible, you're uninsured now, or you just have some very student insurance or some rotten insurance. But we will sell you now for pretty cheap. I think it was like $100 a year or so, the right to buy health insurance from us later on when you get older and maybe get sicker. And that's essentially provides you the same credit. So markets were evolving. What happened under the ACA, they were made illegal. Guaranteed renewable. I have a sister-in-law of mine who I've been very proud of. She didn't make a lot of money, but she had health insurance for all her years as a single person, paying for it out of pocket. Why? Because she understood that by buying health insurance now, she got to keep it if she was going to get sick. And the ACA swept that out from under her. 20 years of scrimping and saving from very low salary, and the ACA made this illegal. Why? We went to a different idea, the idea that that everybody gets to buy health insurance at any time. But the problem that unravels quickly because then only healthy people buy it. So then you have to force everyone to buy it and the costs go up and we're in the current mess. So that's where we are, but there's the possibility remains. And I hope someday we'll get back there. I've talked long enough. You must have some questions.
You said only healthy people buy it, or you meant only unhealthy people buy it?
Sorry. Thanks for the correction and for listening so carefully. Yes, if everyone gets it, what we did now is you can't charge pre-existing conditions. Everyone gets it at the same price. Well, if you offer that, then only people for whom it's a good deal will buy it. So then you have to try to force everybody to buy it, and people don't want to do that and because it's overpriced for healthy people. So you get into the mess we're in now.
So you've argued that American healthcare is badly in need of deregulation, both on the supply side, where regulation makes it difficult for new entrants to compete, and also, as we were talking a little bit, on the demand side, in that individuals have little incentive to think about cost effectiveness because the insurance is paying the bulk of their fees and it's not something that's done out of pocket. Could you summarize why you think that overregulation makes healthcare markets less efficient? And what would a freer market system look like on that supply side?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, so I have pretty good health insurance. I actually pay a lot out of pocket, and many Americans do. So there's a kind of a crisis of big health bills where Americans are paying out of pocket. And then they discover that if you show up at a hospital and you say, I don't have any insurance or I'm paying cash, the little cash registers go, you know, how they, in the old Wile E. Coyote cartoons, cash registers, and you get the list price, which is designed for Saudi princes with heart attacks. And we've all seen the insane billing and pricing system in hospitals. What in the world is going on there? Why, as an American, can't you walk in with your cash and get the same kind of treatment your dog gets if you walk into a vet and you say, I'm paying cash, and they, you know, here's a list of perfectly reasonable prices for fixing your dog. I think I went in for an EKG recently and the list price was $10,000. You've got to be kidding me. The outrage starts to flow before I answer questions. The central problem here is you can tell it, you can just feel it. There isn't supply competition. Hospitals are not desperate for even the people who are paying out of pocket. They're not desperate for your money. And there's a web of regulation that stops that. So much medical stuff is done by either the government, something like half now between Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans, by employer-provided health insurance, which is also part of the game. Medicare, Medicaid don't get reimbursed what it costs. There's charity care that doesn't get reimbursed what it costs. Where's the money coming from? The money comes out of private employer-provided health insurance, which is allowed to dramatically overcharge us. Well, that system cannot withstand competition, either on the health insurers or among the hospitals. And if you try to run a cash hospital, you will soon discover you're in deep trouble. Getting permits is hard. Getting the simple things like certificates of need is hard. So there's a lot of barriers to entry to, and it's hard to wedge yourself into a system that's designed around this complicated cross subsidy designed to screw all of us like that. I mean, so what we need, the vision I want is think of, airlines, say that this is they're providing a complex person service and they're desperate for your money. We don't have to pass laws saying airlines need to tell us how much it's going to cost to go from place to place. They advertise their prices. And yeah, they put in the stupid luggage fees and all the rest of it, but we all kind of understand that game and you kind of have a good idea of what you're getting. And in fact, they do a very good job of what hospitals try to do of taking from the rich and giving to the poor. It's called business class. And people voluntarily sign up. You know, health is not just this idea of what's what you need. Health is a complex personal service. And you can do a lot of cross-subsidy if you give people nicer rooms and charge them twice as much. But the vision I want you to think of is a vision where healthcare is provided by intensely competitive, disruptive providers. You know, I don't, how many new hospitals are there in Boston? Compare that to, how many new any other business shows up. Hospitals and banks they've all been there for 20 years. Well, that tells you that the disruptive innovators are not getting into the market. And that's what we all need, which would just dramatically lower the costs, increase the transparency. It would become possible for people not to need health insurance in order to pay, because right now you cannot go in and pay. You need a health insurer to get the negotiated rate. Well, let's just start with, you ought to be able to just go in and pay and get a competitive price. That's the problem. You can go in and pay $10,000 for EKG if you want to, but you don't get the kind of price that results when there's 10 EKG centers, all of them say, sending spam to your iPhone every day saying, hey, come to us. We'll only charge $122. And that's what we need in healthcare.
I have a friend who a couple of years ago was trying to pay out of pocket for some podiatry, like an ingrown toenail. And he called up all around town. Nobody could quote him a price. And when he went in, had like somebody look at it for 5-10 minutes, no major procedure, just a little thing. He walked out and got a bill for $1,200. Why is it that hospitals are unable to tell you the price up front? And what is it that actually determines these prices?
Well, I'm hoping that this is a system that is deliberately opaque, because if us peasants with pitchforks could figure it out, we would be up in arms in the streets. Now, many places you can go in and negotiate a price. If you say, look, I'm paying cash, what's the real price? You can negotiate it. But that is horrendously inefficient. Imagine if, you know, you had to go to United Airlines saying, okay, I know you put up $10,000 on the website because you don't want Medicare and the other guys seeing, but what can we do for a ticket to Chicago? And they say, well, we'll talk to our billing consultant, come to the back room. And they say, well, how about $6,000? And you say, no, that's not worth it. I can go to Delta for less. And they say, well, show me your financial statements and your Form 1040. Oh, I see, you don't really make a lot of money. How about $4,000? That's just an incredibly, that's how we do, you know, pay for it. That's incredibly inefficient way to go about it. Now, why don't we do it? There's lots of contracts that say you may not disclose the prices. if you disclose what I pay to A, then B wants it. So it's deliberately kept obscure. If the insurance company's overpaying because Medicare is underpaying. So if the insurance company finds out that you can get even a lower price than they're getting, then they're upset about that. I'm not an expert on hospital billing, because that's a lifetime career, but we can tell your experience. You just have to be a little bit of an economist. You have that experience. You know, here is a rotten system designed to screw me. And that's exactly right. And you'll be able to tell when you have a competitive system, when you don't need a federal law that they have to disclose their prices, when they are, you know, bombarding you with ads about their prices, when they feel like a need to tell you the price to get your business. And I might add, most of us don't need health insurance. Most of us listening to this, I presume you're a slightly higher income demographic, but if you earn 150 grand a year and you're and you were faced with a competitive, cutthroat price competitive market, you by and large wouldn't need health insurance except for extreme events. You know, if you're the type of person who has, say, 20 grand in the bank, it's really hard to go through that much, you know, unless you get cancer or something of the sort. But you need the ability to buy things on a cash market. Or, you know, the way things used to go is people who didn't have money asked for, you know, there was charity, there was a GoFundMe, there was, you know, churches who helped pay for medical bills. That's all gone. You can't do that, because if you walk in and say, well, you know, he didn't have health insurance, but we're going to help pay him, well, they get the $10,000 price.
I wanted to jump back. You mentioned certificates of need. What exactly are certificates of need, and how exactly do they relate to the supply side new healthcare entrant?
That's a small example of the many regulations we have in place designed to stop competition and keep prices up. And it's a good one, because it started as a cost control method. So this started as, you know, hospitals are buying too many CAT scanners, and that's expensive, and that's going to raise health costs. So we'll pass a law saying that hospitals, before they buy a new CAT scan machine, have to apply to the state and show a need for more CAT scan machines. Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Well, the way it goes now is, I know how it works in Illinois, where I looked into it. It's a state level regulation. To determine, do we need another CAT scanner around here? All the hospitals in the area get to say no. So your competitors get a veto on that. Imagine if every time, you know, Delta wanted to open a flight from San Francisco to Dallas, Civil Aviation Board could ask United and American, hey, do you think we have a need for another flight And they'd say, absolutely not. This is a terrible idea. Oversupply. It's going to drive up costs. That's so when your competitors get a veto, guess what happens? It's one that that's such an obvious, you know, game for reducing supply, driving up prices, that it's attracted a lot of attention. Though I'm not sure it's the most important one as far as, you know, why did you get that bill for, what was it, $10,000 you got the bill for your toenail? Or I forget what ridiculous one it was.
So let's say that you get to be in charge. What are some of the major changes? You don't get, you know, everything on your wish list, but you get the you know, some big ones. What are the primary changes that you would like to see made in U.S. healthcare?
I'll get there, but let's realize why this is so hard. There is, in any case, we have a set of regulations. There's two reasons it's so hard. First, we have this massive regulatory system. It's very similar to the chaos in our financial system, where each step sort of made sense as a patch to the last one. So we put in this employer-provided healthcare tax subsidy. Well, now we got pre-existing conditions. Well, so we'll mandate community rating. Well, now the healthy people don't sign up. Well, now we'll mandate everybody to get it. You know, one after another, each kind of makes sense. So it's, you can't get rid of things one at a time. You know, Medicare and Medicaid don't want to pay what it's worth. So we got to come up for the money. So we'll overcharge the private insurers. Well, now we can't allow competition in private insurance. You know, so there's this pathological system that nonetheless, each individual item has a little bit of logic to it, given all the problems of the other one. So you got to take the whole damn thing down and start from scratch. That's hard. The other reason it's hard is, as everywhere in our sort of, we're not the free market. Sorry, I hate to break it to you. We're the crony capitalist state. There's an enormous number of people who are making great livings on this. Doctors, at least, you know, the restriction on the supply of doctors keeps up prices of doctors, the American Medical Association, but more, the hospitals have learned to work this system. They're making lots of money. You know, what is a hospital president for? It's nice living. The health insurance companies have become specialists at work in this game, which is getting, you know, working with the regulators, making sure there isn't too much competition, making sure we get enough money in here. So the regulators, the hospitals, the massive bureaucracy in charge of this stuff, that Social Security, Health and Human Services, they all like the current system. And my fellow health economists, there is an enormous body of people who do health policy research and whose job it is to understand the intricacies of Medicare billing and to write papers about how we might fiddle with the system. We throw this system out, they're all out of money, a lot of jobs. And the soft money research institutes that study this stuff are all gone. So there's an enormous political, you know, lots of people have a vested interest in the system. Okay, you asked the question and I cleared my throat for a long time. Now the answer. This just needs a grand amount of get out of the way. Sensible get out of the way. There is nothing wrong that a private insurance system can't handle. Now, part of the problem, it's not just federal. We have state insurance regulations in all the 50 states, which are causing a lot of the problems. But I would simply, throw most of it out. Now, you have to create a viable system of individual, portable, well-run health insurance that needs to be done. And you have to let the hospitals know that, you know, the competitive days are coming and new hospitals can open. So you have to just remove a whole bunch of regulation. And there is a problem. So what are we doing here? One of the core problems is, how do we provide healthcare for poor people who can't otherwise pay for it, or health insurance? Now, the problem is, this is a genuine problem, but let me ask, must your and my health insurance be so screwed up to solve the problem of the homeless guy who has a heart attack? No, right? So we do need to create a viable system for those kinds of people, but we need to dissociate we need to not try to pay for that by overcharging our system. Let you and me to the mercies that we can afford the free market. You and me get the mercies of the free market, but you need a system to help people like that. I would actually, so I'm kind of a free market type. So the words tax and spend don't come out of my mouth easily, but I actually think a tax supported system of charity care on budget allocated every year to provide what we think a decent society provides to people up to the level we think are not, shouldn't be required to be responsible for themselves. That is the right answer because taxing and spending is more efficient than monstrous cross subsidies that can't allow competition. You can tax and spend in a ruthlessly competitive environment. You don't have to have monopolies like they did for the baby formula, if you're taxing and spending. So in other words, bottom line answer, you need a robust system of charity care. I would prefer it to be tax and on budget spending. And then as soon as possible, the rest of us are basically just have a great bonfire of the ACA and the health insurance regulations and all the rest of it.
All right. Now a difficult question.
Oh, you, like the other ones weren't? Go ahead.
So what is the strongest argument that you hear or you can make in favor of more healthcare regulation?
Well, regulation is not more or less. Regulation is smart or dumb, effective or ineffective, full of unintended consequences or working as intended. I don't like to put more or less. How many thousands of pages of regulation do we have? Has any human being actually read them all? Probably not. So the argument, we just need more like that. I can't see any reason we need more like that. Do we need some regulation? Sure. So if we go back to the, you know, complete state of nature, I don't mind a little bit of regulation. There's some information issues. So at least I'm not so sure I like the FDA the way it is, but the FDA could give a badge of approval saying, here's a drug. We think this is past its clinical trials and it's pretty good. Now that the FDA says you can't take it until we've done that seems to me like a pretty monstrous problem. And that the FDA says you can't even see, they banned the rapid tests for months. We're so paternalistic. We won't let you see the results of what's inside your own body, even though it can't possibly hurt you to take it. You know, they're way off the end. But you know, the idea of government agencies as certifying information, and you know, if you're taking a drug that isn't FDA approved, you're taking a risk. That kind of basic regulation, basic health and safety regulation. There's a point at which you're talking about practical things and a point at which you're having a libertarian discussion of which cloud of libertarian nirvana are we going to live on? Do we require airline pilots' licenses or should those be privately provided? I don't know. But, you know, we got 99% of the way to get there before we talk about that sort of stuff.
On the topic of libertarian in the sky sorts of conversations, in Milton Friedman's PhD, he talks about occupational licensing and argued that it artificially restricts the supply of services, raising prices. Are physician licenses just another form of medieval guilds?
They are also another form of medieval guilds. And that's what he noticed. So medieval guilds, it was the same basic idea. They went to the king and said, look, we can't have people providing substandard teacups because the poor customer will get screwed by substandard teacups. So we need to allow that only properly certified guild members provide teacups so that we know that the customer is not being taken advantage of. And the king said, oh, well, that sounds reasonable. We wouldn't want bad teacups here. But of course, then getting into the teacup makers guild, you have to be usually the son, sorry for the sexist language, the way it was back then, of a teacup maker to get into the teacup makers guild. And surprise, surprise, teacups get expensive. Teacup makers are doing a good job. And the legislation that has perhaps a purpose gets used for some other purpose. And I think that's what's going on. Getting, the AMA doesn't just say, here are the standards you have to pass to become a doctor. They limit the number of residencies here, limit on the number of doctors who can become doctors. There's limits on who, if you're licensed to practice in one state, can you practice in another state? It was interesting, you know, we discovered the pathology of this in the pandemic. Nurses certified in one state are not allowed to work in another state. Well, what happens when New York is exploding with COVID and we got a whole bunch of nurses in New Jersey who could go help people from dying, but they're not certified to practice in state? Well, we declare a state of emergency and they're allowed for a while, but that emergency is going over and it's coming back to the usual pathology. So I'm pushing back a little on your just, but it is in fact that occupational licenses do restrict entry and drive up costs.
So one thing that's sort of interesting about all the rules and regulations, or I guess this is really the unintended consequences of the physician licensing. There are all these industries within medicine, one example being we have to take licensing exams in order to become licensed doctors. You have to take them. And these natural monopolies, like within medicine, are such that I think that in order to get licensed as a physician, you take 3 licensing exams, your boards. And I think it's like $2,000 to $3,000 total in order to do this. And it's just, there's nothing you can do. There's no competition. There's no alternative. You are required to pay this guild fee in order to progress into the realm of physicians.
The real problem is the exam. Before you guys work on me, I'd like you to take a couple tests. Thank you. I'd like the guy who flies my plane to have passed the FAA instrument rating and airline transport rating and be current on his proficiency. In some fields, these things go off the deep end. You know, to run a nail salon, you need something like 1,500 hours of training and long exam. That's clearly, the exam is being used as a way to keep people out. It's not clear to me that medical exams are being used. And in fact, I know in medicine and law, you're now under kind of stress under equity to make these exams less stringent. But the the problems are not just the taking of an exam. The problems are the limitations on the number of people who are allowed in medical school. Can foreign doctors certify? I like your idea. And as long as we're on clouds of libertarian Nevada, maybe there should be 2 or 3 competitive exam services. I like free data. It's remarkable to me in medicine how little data is collected, even by our lovely government. I'd like to know how many of your patients survived. I'd like to know a lot about you. I'd like to know the exam that you took 25 years ago. Yeah, that you passed. And did you pass the AMA exam or the chiropractic exam? I'd rather the AMA exam. I'd rather more competitive exams. But I'd also rather, we have this information problem of, do I know if you're in any good? We could be doing a lot more on that. I'm just struck on how little retrospective data is available. If I go to a hospital, what's the death rate in this hospital? What's the death rate from X procedure? What's Dr. X's death rate? You know, we found for taxis that Uber stars are far more effective than did you pass the taxi driver exam on getting us safe taxi drivers. I don't know if you've had this experience, or you guys may not have been, if you've ever taken an old fashioned taxi where they're going 80 miles an hour down at the side street, the taxi driver exam didn't, and taxi regulation didn't seem to do a very good job. Uber stars are doing a great job. So I do think that there are alternative mechanisms that even on top of exams, we should be using to help, ensure medical quality. But it's the other restrictions. The exam in one state you can't use in another. Let's at least allow exams in different states. numerical limits on how many doctors there may be. That's new, and you know, the difficulty of getting nurses in the country, for example. So there's a lot of supply restrictions, even occupational licensing, that are beyond just the need to take an exam. And it's usually an occupational licensing. Milton Friedman made his point with doctors, which was kind of a surprise at the time. But if you look at the Obama White House was very, very good on this. They noticed that this was a problem, and it's a problem at the nail salon level, at the nurse level. You know, bring a nurse from one state to another, she can't work. It's a problem for mobility, for entrepreneurship of people, of, you know, the kind of people who can't become radiologists, but instead are setting up nail salons. Well, they can't move to another state and set up a nail salon. It takes them 1,500 hours and a lot of, you know, that's where occupational licensing is really causing a problem. I don't think it's the number one problem in medicine, actually. The inability to start competitive new hospitals and clinics, you know, and those are, for example, if you start an outpatient clinic, Medicare reimburses you at a lower rate than a hospital. Well, why do we have expensive hospitals and not cheap outpatient clinics? You know, those kinds of things are in the way.
You brought up an interesting thing about transparency and reviews. I've noticed when I Google doctors, you can find some, you know, Yelp-ish reviews, but there's always that problem of, you know, a patient who is going to rate that doctor very positively might just be rating the fact that they were able to get the antibiotic that they didn't need. So how do you, do you have any ideas about how to increase that transparency or have better ability to rank doctors or choose doctors?
Yes. So you bring up a good point. Now, health economists love to make fun of this and say, oh, how terrible that the patients are such morons. They rate on whether the room was clean and whether the doctor was friendly to them. They don't, you know, have actual health metrics. We have to take this over for them. I think it's very telling, though, the extent to which medicine is a complex personal service and not you know, cut and dried, here's what you need, here's what you don't need. And, you know, like air travel, it's not just about that I get you from Boston to Chicago. You know, a lot of what people are willing to pay for is 2 more inches on the seat. And that turns out to matter to people a lot. That's an insight that really should be part of how we think about medicine. But yes, now the problem is I, as an individual patient, I'm not well, it is true. I can't really tell you how well did you fix me until afterwards, unless somebody came and asked me. And this is where in a competitive system, there's a clear need for information aggregators. First of all, if hospitals were competitive, once you're non-competitive, once you're providing a service for the government or for the insurance company, your customer is the government or the insurance company. And if the government or the insurance company doesn't ask for detailed doctor by doctor metrics of how you're doing, there's no reason for you to do it, no reason for you to collect the data, no reason to make the data easy, no reason to access the data. And that's where we are. Anything, once it gets provided by the government, becomes static. It loses the innovation. It loses the desire to get the data together to provide a better actual service to measure what we're doing. So in free market Nirvana land, you'd have competitive hospitals, and the three of us could make a lot of money starting a business that demands from hospitals the data on how well are they doing, demands from doctors, and provides doctor ratings. And you know, I would say, well, Dr. Cochran, he gets a 5.0 rating on his lovely bedside manner, but he's killed 3 of the last 5 patients who've gone to see him. So we're only giving him 2 stars. You know, Morningstar gives mutual fund ratings. They're largely garbage, but at least there's a business here in you know, helping people to establish that. And hospitals would have the incentive to collect this data and to advertise how good they are and to become better. To you know, as it would be, if they were having to compete for people to come to them, you know, one of the things they do is here's how much we'll charge you, and the other thing they would do is and here's our data for how great our actual, and here's our third party certifier, you know, the Institute of Evaluating Doctors, who says we're the, you know, the number 3 around here. So I think Yes, Yelp rate. I'm glad you brought it up because Yelp ratings are, would be a terrible idea as our only method for evaluating doctors, because it's a complex service.
Do you have any thoughts on the hospital price transparency law, which went into effect in January? My understanding is that a lot of hospitals just aren't complying with it, and they get like, you know, $100 or $300 a day fine for it, but they're okay keeping what they charge for an MRI or or a hip replacement under wraps.
It is it's an interesting idea, and I suggest you have on your podcast Thomas Phillipson, who was one of the architects of this thing in the Trump administration. He was part of the Council of Economic Advisors, and I've fought with I've talked to him and Casey Mulligan, who's also on the CA, who's part of this idea. I'm skeptical. Why were they hiding their prices in the first place? Well, there must be some strong economic incentive for them to hide their prices in the first place to make the whole thing as complicated as your taxes, so no one can figure out what the hell's going on. There's a strong reason for them to do that. So simply passing a law, they're going to try to get around the law. And I'm reminded of, I was in a hotel room a while ago, and I paid like $140 a night for the hotel, something of the sort. And the back of the door was, per state law, we have to disclose the maximum price of this hotel room, $6,000 a night. You know, clearly, you know, we get around these disclosures when there's a need for specialties. I think pharmacy benefit management is probably the fifth circle of hell on this whole business of non-transparent pricing, special deals. You get a discount, I get a discount, but you can't. They have actually rules. You're not allowed to tell other people what the prices are, and so on and so forth. The mess of a non-competitive market. So, yeah, I think its heart was in the right place, but I think we need to figure out why it is that hospitals don't want to tell you what their prices is and will fight tooth and nail not to do so, whereas airlines are fighting tooth and nail to tell you what their prices are. There's something different in their economic incentive about telling you the prices. And really, that's the only thing that's going to cure it and bring the prices down.
What important truth do very few of your economics colleagues agree with you on?
Fiscal theory of the price level, but that's a topic for another day. I also work on inflation. You want health or non-health?
Anything.
On health economics, I think there is a widespread view in professional health economists that the litany of problems we learn in Econ 101 means that health has to be run by the government. For example, they will cite asymmetric information. Now, I cite back, that doesn't work. So the story is, you know more about your health than the insurance company, so only sick people will sign up for insurance. And that's the story we tell in Econ 101, and they repeat it over and over again. But wait a minute, you know, in the modern day, a health insurance company armed with your medical health care records knows way more about your likely future health costs than you do. So the asymmetric information goes the other way. And in fact, the reason everybody gets charged the same price is not because the health insurance company can't tell us apart, but because the government forbids them from charging the same price. So that's just an example I'll give you of, you know, there is this widespread view, oh, it has to be run by the government, as you mentioned earlier, and that's common among health economists as well. And I think they've sort of taken those stories at face value and then jumped into how do we fix the Medicare reimbursement codes for X, Y, and Z, rather than thinking from first principles about why is this thing so screwed up? Are there really economic impediments to markets working here?
You've written about improving the writing of PhD students. And from reading your work, you write very lucidly. It's very, I don't know, it's just very enjoyable to read. What recommendations do you have for non-PhD students who want to improve their writing?
Oh, doctors in particular. Writing it, so we are all writers more than we think. And writing good nonfiction prose is difficult. Writing simple, clear, and to the point in a way that I'm clearly not able to do in person. It's a lot about editing, getting the first things first, saying things in, not using the big Latin word, dear doctors, I don't know Latin. Why don't you talk to me in English? And don't tell me I have, this is from my mother. Don't tell me I have idiopathic senile pruritus. Tell me I'm old and my skin itches. For reasons we don't know. I like, but you have to study writing. So I got a lot out of William Zinsser's book on writing well, which was a, you know, just how do you do nonfiction prose? But keep it simple. Think about your audience and make a study of writing that you like and writing that you don't like.
So before we close, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to mention?
Oh, of course, there's lots to touch on, but let's leave it there. We should all open our eyes to the possible and not just tinker with the current system. This holds generally true for our country, which I think has become what Mark Stein calls the Republic of Paperwork, stuck in vastly too complicated systems where there's a pretense that our regulators are adjusting things at a fine level, but in fact, the whole thing is falling apart. So we need to, I refer to it as a great Marie Kondoing of our public life. Go out there, clean out the drawer, get not deregulation, simple, effective, scientifically tested, retrospectively evaluated, cost-benefit, positive regulatory state that actually works and get this country moving again. Healthcare in the same way that we need finance and infrastructure and everything else to stop waiting for the permits and get back to building a serious country.
Thank you so much for joining us on the External Medicine Podcast. For people that want to read and learn more about you on the internet, where would you have them go?
I would have them go to the Grumpy Economist blog and to my website, john.cochran.com. Just Google me, John Cochran. My website and my blog come up first. There's an E on the end of Cochran. That's all you need to know.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to support us, here are some ways you can help. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, preferably a phenomenal review. Visit us at externalmedicinepodcast.com and tell your friends.